Case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Wengler against Druggists Mutual Insurance Company. Reed, you may begin whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. The question presented in this particular case is whether the 1976 revised statutes of Missouri, section 287.240, which authorizes workers' compensation death benefits for the spouse of a male worker without regard to dependency, but conditions benefits for the spouse of a female worker upon mental and physical incapacity or proof of dependency, discriminates impermissibly on the basis of gender in violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution. This case arose at the death of Ruth Wengler on February 11, 1977. Thereafter, workman compensation claim was filed by the claimant for the death of his wife. The referee and the Industrial Commission of the State of Missouri held that they did not have the authority to declare the Missouri statute provision on the death benefits unconstitutional and therefore disallowed the claim. The claim was appealed to the Circuit Court of Madison County, where the circuit judge there held that due to the Missouri Constitution and the federal Constitution, the Equal Protection Clause, the death benefits to the workman compensation for Paul Wengler had been denied, and therefore ruled in favor of the claimant and indicated that the benefits should be applied to Mr. Wengler for the death of his wife. Thereafter, Druggist Mutual appealed this decision to the Missouri Supreme Court. And there, in a divided opinion, the Missouri Supreme Court reversed the Circuit Court of Madison County, holding that they would not apply the strict scrutiny test as it had been applied by members of this court in appropriate sex discrimination cases, but instead applied the other tests that have been applied, substantial relation test, and held that under the substantial relation test, that the Equal Protection Clause had not been violated by the Missouri Workman Compensation Benefit Statute. But Justice Donnelly, in a concurring opinion, basically indicated that he was troubled because he didn't know what the supreme law of the land was. And Justice Seiler, in his opinion, which was a dissenting opinion, the sole dissenting opinion, pointed out that the majority opinion, even though it applied the substantial relation test, that the, in his opinion, that this court would have found that the Missouri Workman Compensation death benefit violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment of this Constitution, and pointing out that members of this court had applied and the substantial relation test, and therefore the substantial relations test and the strict scrutiny test both would not pass the Missouri Workman Compensation death benefit as it applied in the state of Missouri in the Wengler case. And the dissenting opinion would have held in favor of the claimant. After this case was accepted and briefs started being written, received a telephone call from the Department of Justice and also the American Civil Liberties Union, and they both filed amicus curiae briefs on behalf of the claimant. And I thought that this was very strange when I received the phone call. from the Department of Justice because the American Civil Liberties Union, Department of Justice, had been litigating these matters before this court in the Social Security cases, in the federal cases. And after obtaining the amicus curiae brief from the Department of Justice, I found out that what happened after the GOFAB case, the Social Security case, which is a 5-4 decision, that Congress thereafter instructed the Department of Justice to go through the Social Security laws and to advise Congress how the gender discrimination in the Social Security law could be corrected. And according to the brief of the Department of Justice, they have complied with that public law, which is on page 3 of the amicus curiae's brief, and in February of 1979, they have made a report back to Congress of how the gender-based discrimination can be corrected by Congress. So I think that this is a expression by Congress that they want to correct the gender-based discrimination that still is in the Social Security laws.
Did Congress do anything in response to that report?
Justice Winquist, I think that this report took place in February of 1979, and to my knowledge, and what I have is from the amicus curiae brief, Congress has not passed any laws at this time. I think that it is a claimant's position that the Missouri majority misread and misapplied the tests that have been applied by this court. And to be quite fair, with the Missouri Supreme Court, there were some cases that came down about the same time as the Missouri decision last term, this court, the Orr case and also the Westcott case. And those cases, the plurality of the court held that the alimony statute, state of Alabama, violated the Equal Protection Clause, and also a portion of the federal statute on aid to dependent children also violated the Equal Protection Clause, where it only applied benefits to the father who was unemployed and not to a mother that was unemployed. I think the American Civil Liberties Union, of course, I have a client, not a cause. The American Civil Liberties Union would like to see the court adopt the strict scrutiny test. Quite frankly, I don't believe that the decisions of this court in the past decade would have been any different if the strict scrutiny test, which Justice Brennan has written about in the many decisions in 1970, would have been applied by the court. The court has held in the Kahn case, a decision written by Justice Douglas, that in the area of taxation, that the Constitution and this court has given states great leeway. And this is a particular area where they have done that. And I think that under that particular decision, that applying the strict scrutiny test, that that decision would stand. The Schlesinger versus Ballard case involved a decision involving up and out of the forces, armed forces. A member of the armed forces who was a officer had to move up or be booted out of the service. And this court held the plurality that in that particular case that the Constitution gave to Congress the authority to man the services. And that this was a legitimate purpose and that the court would not use the Equal Protection Clause to take away that duty and that power that is delegated to Congress. In Califano versus Webster, which was a per curiam decision of this court, and there was a decision that a provision of the Social Security Act, which gave benefits to a woman by deducting 3 years off of her earnings requirements for benefits, that this was a specific act of Congress to do away with some past discriminations that women had been shackled with over the many years. The
Mr. Reed, you think the Missouri statute discriminates against men or against women?
I think it discriminates against both, Justice Stevens. I think it discriminates against a working woman. I think perhaps a few decades ago it was a place for the woman to remain in the home and take care of the children. Today, with inflation, with our way of life, a number of women work outside the home and raise a family. And so by denying the workman compensation benefits, it does discriminate against not only males but also females.
Doesn't deny any women any benefits in this case, does it?
It does deny her family benefits. In the event she would pass away, her family would be discriminated against. Whereas if the husband passed away, she would be entitled to benefits for her and the children. But the shoe on the other foot, if the wife passes away, the mother, then the father has a void there.
Talking about members of the family other than the spouse, aren't they treated alike? Aren't the children treated as dependents in both cases?
Yes.
So there isn't any discrimination against anybody except the opposite spouse, is there?
Other than the fact that the opposite spouse could use the money that would be entitled, that he would be entitled to help raise a family.
Do you have any intellectual difficulty at all
with the claim that this system is unconstitutional because it discriminates against both men and women?
No, Your Honor.
I must say I do.
You mean it would have to discriminate
against
one?
How could something discriminate against both? Right. Let's say aliens and non-aliens.
Right. It would discriminate against, I would say in this particular case, it would discriminate against the man, the male, the way the statute's written in this particular set of facts.
You mean in some cases it might discriminate against women, in other cases it might
family.
Discriminate against
men? I see what Justice Stevens is saying, that in, how can it in this case, because the wife is the one that's deceased, she's never going to
receive. But your point is that in some cases the discrimination might be against women, and in other cases it might be against men. Is that it? It's against
it could be
women
against,
if you think of them as wage earners.
Right.
And it's against men if you think of them as beneficiaries.
Right.
Is that it?
Right.
So it would depend in each case upon whether the male or the female were the wage earner and which spouse was the beneficiary.
That's correct.
I see.
Does the wage earner in this case contribute to the fund that provides the benefits?
Your Honor, I think indirectly he does, or she does in this particular case. I realize that Druggist Mutual's brief and correctly states what the law in Missouri is, that the employer is the one who pays the benefits on the workman compensation. But indirectly, all wage earners pay into that fund.
Well, until there's an injury, I take it there's no discrimination as between wage earners of different sexes. They both pay the same percentage.
Yes,
I mean, neither of them has any deduction from his salary, and there's no difference.
No, Your Honor, there'd be no deduction from the salary, other than the fact, I think, when you think about the total amount of labor, that the employer would take this into consideration, how much he is paying in for the workman compensation benefits.
Well, but he pays in the same amount for a female worker as he does
for
a male worker.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct.
And if the female and male workers are single and have no dependents at all, so they only would get benefits for disability, they're treated alike.
That's correct.
I don't see any discrimination against anybody except a male in this case. I don't understand the theory of discrimination against the female.
Well, it has been advanced, I think, in the American Civil Liberties brief, and it's pointed out in some other cases that it does discriminate against the working woman for her family, and that would be the discrimination. That theory has been advanced.
You mean because the husband is the wife of a woman, he's discriminated. I mean, is the spouse of a woman, he's discriminated against. So that's a discrimination against the woman.
The woman would be discriminated because of her ability to support her family in the event that she had passed away. That's the theory, the argument that is used.
That her employment is worth less than the man's.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's the theory that I get. This court has held that the following classifications violate the Equal Protection Clause. In the Reed case, to eliminate hearings on appointment of administrators, Justice Berger, in his opinion, indicated that that was not a legitimate classification, giving preference to a male over a female. Also in the Reed case, to avoid inter-family controversy, that was not a valid classification. Administrative convenience in the decision by Justice Brennan in the Frontero decision was not a valid reason for the classification. In the Wiesenfeld decision, Justice Brennan's opinion, the fact that the women were primary, these men were primary supporters, the fact that the women were given benefits in the event of the husband's death to take care of the children, which is very close to this case, that benefits should be paid to the male in the event of the wife's decease. And in the Craig case, Justice Brennan points out that statistical data is not very helpful in deciding equal protection cases. The accident of birth, and that's what this is, sexual classification, gender classification. It's an accident of birth. And in the GOFAB case, which is very similar to this one, it was a Social Security case. And I would say that the dissenting opinions in those cases indicated that this was social legislation. The workman compensation benefit cases are not social type cases. Legislation that Justice Windquist was writing about in his dissent. And finally, in the Westcott case, Justice Blackburn indicated that the one-step test that was advanced in the dissenting opinion in GOFAB no longer would be followed by this court. I would also point out to the court that the strict scrutiny test is based upon race, and that was an amendment to this Constitution by the 15th Amendment. And some 50 years after that, an amendment was passed, the 19th Amendment, and that gave women the right to vote. And in this classification, I think that this could be a suspect classification. Strict scrutiny should be applied to sexes as well as race, because sex is an even broader term than race, alienage, or national origin. All races have two sexes that become extinct. This is a law of nature. Justice Powell, in his concurring opinion, has indicated in the Craig decision that due to the fact that the Equal Rights Amendment is pending, that the court should not go ahead and apply the strict scrutiny test at this particular time. I would point out that the race and the sex are both amendments to this Constitution, and perhaps as the American Civil Liberty Union has stressed, that it is time to apply the strict scrutiny test in these gender classification cases.
When you say scrutiny test, so-called, in every case simply is a shorthand for saying you're going to invalidate the statute, isn't it?
I think that didn't happen in the...
I mean, that just is a way of telegraphing the result, isn't it?
In the Webster case, that didn't happen. And also, I think Justice Brennan in the Bakke case held that he would not use a strict scrutiny standard to invalidate that. Of course, that was a race case. It wasn't a sex case. But that it is a stricter standard. That's correct.
Well, then, right. Isn't what I asked in my question basically correct?
Yes.
Do you know of a single case in which this any court has ever applied the so-called strict scrutiny test that it has not ended up by invalidating the statute before it?
I would say that the Webster case would be a close one, Judge. A per curiam opinion of this court.
Yes. Rely a good bit on the fact this statute is an old one and dates back many years.
1925, Your Honor.
Suppose that it were enacted last year and there was a distinct legislative record to the effect that the legislature wanted to compensate widows for deprivations of the past. Would you be here today?
I think I would if the court would apply the strict scrutiny standard, yes, Your Honor. Because this...
I repeat Mr. Justice Stewart's question. doesn't the strict scrutiny standard really speak for the result? Once you take that standard, it's the result is inevitable.
Yes, Your Honor, I would say that it would be.
It's like a compelling state interest. Yeah. We've used that up here many times, and every time we use it, it indicates the result.
A couple of voting cases as a restriction has been sustained over that kind of a test. And I suppose the origin in race cases was in the Japanese relocation case, which was sustained.
Of course, that did not involve, these did not involve the equal protection clause.
That involved the Fifth Amendment.
The Fifth Amendment. That involved federal action. Long before, it had been perceived that the due process clause of the Fifth Amendment contained some equal protection ingredient.
Not so in the voting cases lately.
Mr. Reed, could I return for a minute to this case? What is the? I take it there are alternate remedies that would be permissible if you prevail. Either they could require proof of dependency from survivors of both sexes, or eliminate proof of dependency. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And if they required proof of dependency from both sexes, that wouldn't cause any harm to male applicants, but it would cause a lot of female applicants to lose the benefits, wouldn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And if they took the converse, it would give a lot of money to male applicants and take nothing away from female applicants.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So either way, male applicants as a class will benefit, won't they, if you prevail?
If we prevail, yes. That's correct. I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Is there any other questions?
Mr. Kleinschmidt.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I'll try not to restate anything that appears in the brief, but I would like to make some points that I don't think have been emphasized by the briefs. We're talking in this case about a workman's compensation law. I think possibly the first time that this court has had an industrial accident law in context with gender discrimination. Most of the cases in this area have arisen out of Social Security laws or federal welfare laws of one type or another, and they have not arisen out of workman's compensation laws. There are differences between these laws, and I think the difference may well influence the case. So I'd like to go back and talk about the history and the origin and the philosophy that underlies a workman's compensation law. As you recall, these laws came into being in the early part of the century in Missouri in the 1920s, and they came into being because of a distinct need which had arisen in an industrialized society. People were getting hurt in the factories. Unfortunately, the remedy available to them, the common law remedy of master-servant, was not sufficient at the time. Statistically, about 30% of these people received any recovery. When recoveries were received, it was an uneven handling of it. Too many received nothing at all because the common law defenses of master-servant, contributory negligence, fellow-servant rule, barred claims from being made, and the result created not only a terrible problem for the injured working person, but for society itself, because these people had to became wards, or tended to become wards of society when they were hurt or when people were killed in industry. It was in response to that need that the workman's compensation concept was worked out. The objective of the compensation concept was to pass on to industry, which is the area where people get hurt, the cost of these injuries. The notion was to get certain benefits and with prompt payment into the hands of the injured working people. The method that was used to achieve this result was a bargain method. That's important. All of these rights and duties and liabilities that appear in workmen's compensation laws, and certainly in the laws of Missouri, are bargained rights and liabilities. That's exactly how the law was put together there. The trade associations, labor unions representing the working people on the one hand, various management organizations representing management through the public forum of the legislature. And everybody had to give up something to get something. The result in Missouri and elsewhere was a law that provided a brand new remedy, wholly substitutional, an exclusive remedy before an administrative tribunal. The benefits the law granted were limited to economic loss. This was the only thing to be paid under workman's compensation, and everything else was given up. One of the great things the employees had to give up in order to obtain liability without fault and reparation for economic loss was the opportunity to obtain the general damages, damages for anything other than economic loss. But the whole workman's compensation concept is based upon reparation of economic loss to the employee or to the employee's dependents. The workman's compensation scheme measures this economic loss by medical payments on the one hand, weekly benefits for temporary disabilities, amounts for permanent disabilities rated on by weeks, and in cases of death, the formula used is based upon dependency. The point of all of this is that in this kind of a law, which, and incidentally, the employee contributes nothing to it, specifically by statute is not allowed to in Missouri. Of course, I suppose you'd call it a fringe benefit. It's a cost, but it's, the cost of this is borne by the employer. The net effect of all of this is that the purpose of the workman's compensation law is to pay for economic loss only, nothing else. And so if a death occurs, as in this unfortunate case here, where there is no economic loss, and it's stipulated there is no economic loss, this law was never meant to provide, Mr. Wengler.
What about if the man dies?
Beg pardon?
What about if the man dies? You don't have to show it, do you? You don't have to show economic loss, do you?
No, and of course I'll get to that because that is a conclusive presumption that brings us here today.
Suppose a man is making $5,000 a year and his wife is making $50,000. If he dies, she collects.
There is no question about that.
Mr. Kleinschmidt, I didn't understand that there was a stipulation that there was no economic loss. I thought there was a stipulation that the husband was not dependent on the wife.
I equated the two because under the scheme of the Missouri statute, they are.
Well, but assume we didn't have a Missouri statute. Would it not be true that if you have two working spouses and both contributing to the household and you lose the income of one, that there's an economic loss for the pair?
Well, economic losses would be the final balance sheet. Some expenses aren't going to be there either, so the balance sheet might end up equally. From an economic loss standpoint, a pure balance sheet standpoint, no, there might not be an economic loss in that instance.
Do you think if a family is supported by both parents and one of them dies and that income is taken away from the family, there's no economic loss suffered by the family as a matter of tort law or any other?
Certainly, if we're going to extend this to a family, if you have two people...
But just the two, do you think you don't think there's economic loss? If you have mortgage payments to meet and all the rest, and you can depend on both incomes to meet...
I think maybe this can be in the mind of the beholder, and as I behold it, I visualize two people in the family making $5,000 apiece. Each of them have to spend $5,000 to live. One dies...
The stipulation is not that there's no economic loss. The stipulation is that there's no dependency.
You're certainly correct.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Now, this statute creates a conclusive presumption.
Yes, sir.
So it precludes any inquiry into the economic realities.
Yes, sir. It does indeed. Yet we feel comfortable with this statute in light of the decisional law of this court, most of which has been made within the last decade. The cases we rely on primarily are Kahn versus Shevin, Schlesinger against Ballard, Califano against Webster. In this series of cases and in others, every member of this court has, upon occasion, agreed that there are some gender classifications which are constitutionally permissible. There's been agreement among all of the members of the court as to what the requirements are for that constitutional basis. It's been agreed by the members of the court, as I understand it, unanimously, that where there is a proper governmental purpose And the law is substantially related to the achievement of that purpose, it is constitutionally permissible. And this Court has agreed that a proper governmental purpose is the reduction of past disparity to women caused by longstanding discrimination. All of those things fit into the Missouri scheme of workman's compensation.
Why does it fit in to treat women one way and men another?
Well, by definition, if you are going to justify a gender classification on the basis of a legitimate governmental purpose in reducing past disparity, to that extent that you are reducing past disparity, then you're not treating, by definition, females equal with the males. But there's a permissible reason for doing that.
Classification. Why don't you have individual determinations? If you had individual determinations, every person who was entitled to it would be recognized. Any person who is actually dependent.
Another recognized governmental purpose is administrative convenience. And by administrative convenience, I'm not talking about the saving of court personnel time, but I'm talking about the certainty of determination and the promptness of payment of benefits. And if we had individual determinations, we would lose that convenience. And that is an important factor, Your Honor. Anybody that's ever walked into an industrial accident board anywhere in this country knows the red tape and what occurs, and you've got to have a certainty of the payment of benefits and promptness of that payment. This is an administrative convenience. It justifies, in part, along with the reduction of past disparity, the distinction of genders in this case.
It only does if you give one remedy rather than the other. If you didn't require proof of dependency for either sex, that would be administratively even more efficient than the present scheme, wouldn't it?
Yes, but as the Missouri Supreme Court pointed out, there's a delicate balance in these acts. This costs money. The District of Columbia, I see in your local press this morning, is facing that right now. Nobody was intended to get anything under the Missouri scheme except for economic loss. If Mr. Wengler, in this case, and all others situate similarly, were to be paid, a large cost comes into these things. Each death case today takes a reserve in six figures now. That's from an insurance company standpoint. And there's a lot of money involved in this thing on that account for a purpose that was never the legislative purpose. If they would change the act, and incidentally, the fact is there's a brand new workman's compensation law pending today in the legislature in Missouri, and if passed, this problem would not arise. I don't know whether it's going to pass or not, but it changes a lot of things in the law. Now, these things go on. I'm just saying that under this particular law, certainly it was permissible.
Is increased cost something that we can take into consideration?
Beg pardon?
Is increased cost to the employer something we can take into consideration? The fact that you'll have to pay out more money if the statute is changed?
Well, I was making it in response to a question here, of course. I think no, of course not. Analytically, technically, from a constitutional standpoint, no.
Well, then I misunderstood you. I'm sorry.
No, I was simply trying to answer that question, Your Honor.
Just as a matter of curiosity, Mr. Kleinschmidt, under the new bill, will they require proof of dependency in all cases or in no cases?
Under the new bill, as I understand it, I read it briefly on the airplane coming up. Apparently, there's going to be a conclusive presumption for both genders.
I see.
Yes.
A presumption of dependency.
Yes. Yes. There has been no attempt to make an argument in this case that I have heard that the classification used in this case was not a proper governmental purpose and was not substantially related to the achievement of the purpose. That's the test. That's the present law that this Court has announced. The thing that bothers is worrisome is that it's obvious that if to reverse the Missouri decision It seems to me this court will have to strictly scrutinize the law, which is a method of saying, I certainly agree, that when you strictly scrutinize, you're invalidating the law. Certainly that's what amicus American Civil Liberties Union wants. They want this court to issue that clarion call that all sex discrimination cases shall be inherently suspicious and in effect make absolute and inflexible standards out of these gender classifications.
What standard do you think Boren suggests?
I'm not prepared to respond.
Well, do you think there's some standard between, in our cases, between just rationality and strict scrutiny? It's hard to say.
It's very difficult to say, Your Honor. It's in the mind of the beholder, really. The only thing that we in the field out there get is that we do talk about classifications, which are shorthand, really sometimes meaning what the result will be. The only thing I can be certain of is that I know that this court has accepted some classifications. I know that some classifications make common sense. I believe in this classification. It doesn't harm anybody. This man has not been harmed. And he sustains no loss. Yet, by putting this into the act, these widows are benefited. And a class of widows are benefited that I think...
You say this man hasn't been harmed.
Beg pardon?
You say this man... Is anything in the record to show that this woman never put a nickel in the house?
It stipulated that there was just absolutely no dependency.
Yeah.
And that's the economic loss rule in Missouri.
And that's the harm. That shows no harm.
I'm not talking in terms of harm, Your Honor. If we talk about that, of course, we can say there's harm. You lose a wife, my golly, how can we say otherwise? I'm talking about the economic loss as measured by the Missouri scheme of workman's compensation.
You're talking about economic loss. You're talking about what it'll cost the company. I know that. I recognize that.
Well, in any event... It seems to us that if this court would reverse the Missouri court in this case, it would be sending out a signal itself that it has been prepared to move to sound this clarion call that ACLU looks for. And I think it's terribly unwise to do that at a time when the Equal Rights Amendment is pending in the legislatures of this land. This court's going to be faced so soon inexorably with the questions of draft, registration, golly knows what else. It seems to me that the thing to do is to stand on this case and affirm this judgment right now and take up the cases of true importance as they come. That's my argument, Your Honors.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Reed?
Yes, just a couple minutes of rebuttal, Your Honor. The statute that's pending before the Missouri legislature is a result of this case and a result of the editorials written by the two metropolitan papers in St. Louis and in Kansas City. I would respond to that. And Mr. Klingsmith is correct that under that proposal that both spouses would be presumed to be dependent. And I would state in closing that irregardless whether the substantial relationship test or the strict scrutiny test is used, that under the decisions in the 70s of this court, Mr. Wengler should prevail. And I thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in United States against Radat.